You're right, time to start. I always start at 8:59.
Oh.
Hello everyone. Welcome to our daily broadcast. November 28th, 2015. No Dhammapada today. I can have a few announcements first, and then answer some questions. Maybe talk about the quote, and then call it a night. So I have somewhat of an announcement. We have meditators here today. There's two people staying overnight, and there's another one supposed to be coming to stay with us for a couple weeks. She should be here sometime this evening, though it's already 9 p.m., so we'll see. Tomorrow we have meetings, no? Do we tell people about these volunteer meetings?
Yes, we're always welcoming new people to join that group, definitely.
Yeah, the volunteer meeting's at 1 p.m., right?
Yes. For people that are on Facebook, there's a Sirimangalo International Volunteer Group on Facebook, and we disseminate some of the information there. We also have a Sirimangalo International YouTube channel, and that's where the meetings are broadcast, and I also usually put it into the meditation chat as well for anyone who'd like to watch or join the hangout. And I think tomorrow we'll hopefully be discussing what we can do for a project, the project that you had discussed, or a holiday project.
Yeah, no word from Sundamali yet. Any questions?
Yes. Hello, Bhante. Whenever we do walking meditation, I have been told that when a distraction comes to mind while we are practicing, we should stop walking and allow the thought to pass. Is there a specific way to do this for walking meditation? I think I'm treating it more like sitting meditation than walking when I do this. Am I supposed to treat it this way? If not, how do I deal with these while doing walking meditation? I want to get full benefit from my practice. Thank you.
Thoughts, is it? Having thoughts when you walk? Or pain, was it?
Distractions.
Distractions. I don't understand the stop and let it pass. That's not really the way this works. You stop and you meditate on it. You apply the technique to it. But the technique of stopping would be like, technically you'd be doing stopping, stopping, standing, standing, and then you'd say distracted, distracted, or thinking, thinking. Whatever the, if it was pain, then you'd say pain, pain. And when it's gone, then you'd go back to the stomach, to the feet, and walking, and start walking again. But you would stop. Don't just keep walking. If it's something that doesn't really distract you, there's like a minor thought, and there's a stray thought, and you can ignore it, and if you want to be able to keep walking. But if it's something that distracts you, you can stop, and there's no reason not to stop. We're not going to get anywhere. It's not like we're trying to get anywhere. In the time, in the ancient times, if you read the Satipatthana commentary, whenever something distracted them when they were walking on alms round, they would back up to where they had lost their distraction, something like that. They would go back, and so it would take them a very long time to get into the monastery. Oh no, they would stop. That's what it was. And when they stopped, the person behind them would know that they had been distracted. So they were all very, very conscientious because Nobody wants to be the guy to hold everybody else up.
To make the distracted guy stand at the end of the line. Hello, Bhante. I want to get a cat, and I'm teetering between wanting to get one and not wanting to get one. Any advice? What do you think of cats? Thanks for answering this mundane cat question.
Yeah, I'm not going to fall for that one. I know what happens when you talk about cats on the internet. I made a video about cats once. It got me 16 downvotes.
It's like you made a video about cats?
My number one downvoted video was...
Oh, I think I missed that one.
Oh, yeah. Someone said exactly this. They were thinking of getting a cat. And boy, did I go off on a rant. Yeah. Don't talk negatively about cats on the internet. Of course, I've never been very smart or interested in what's wise, so... I'll go ahead and stick my neck out again. Cats are evil. Don't get a cat. Cats are murderers. They're immoral. They're self-centered. They're useless things. They're worse than useless. They're generally evil. I mean, it's a generalization, just as with human beings. Cats are all different, and you could have a good cat, but not fairly likely. If you, they did a study about this where they sent cameras out on cats and they found that cats kill every day. Even if they're well fed, they still go out and kill at night. So, cat bad. It's just, it's not a very wholesome existence. Dogs, I think, have more potential, objectively speaking. Dogs can be very cruel, but they don't seem to be as abjectly cruel. You know, they don't go out and kill stuff just for fun at night. Of course, they're not as good at it, so that might be that. But that's okay. It's not such a big deal. Get a cow, maybe. Cows are docile. Cows are innocent. Oh, except when they gore you, right? We've had stories about cows. Get a deer, maybe? Deer. No, a deer can be feisty as well.
How about feeding wild animals, like putting out bird seed? And
I believe in it, but it's some people don't. Yeah, bird seed would be good. Feed those birds that don't eat insects, you know, those birds that eat grain. Then you get some really nice friends. Animals that are very innocent. A little bit airheaded, but... Birds aren't the most high-minded creatures, pardon the pun.
They tend to fly into windows and things.
Well, that you can't blame them. Windows are mean.
That's true.
But they just tweet all day. Talking all the time. Talking nonsense, too. Because they don't have words, so they just... Could you imagine tweeting the same thing? Sounds like the internet. It's what the internet, what we become on the internet. What could you imagine if you were limited? That's why they called it Twitter, right? Because we become like stupid birds. Tweet, tweet, tweet. Got nothing profound to say, I'll just say the same thing over and over again.
Yesterday, my family adopted a dog. She's 15 years old. And her breed, it only has a life expectancy of 12, and she's 15. Oh. She's a Labrador, and her owner died. Hmm. They were going to put her down, so for the moment, she's with us.
Well, good luck.
Thanks. She's right here. Maybe I can... She's a very quiet girl. Sleeping a lot because it was a lot of excitement coming home from the vet where they had been holding her, trying to find a home for her. Bhante, I know you have expressed your views on pets before, but since we might already be on a cat tangent, I wanted to mention that my family has decided to euthanize an ill cat. While it brings me shame as I write this, I have done little to stop it. I want to know if there's a way to help this cat's mind before, as it leaves its body. I can't help the cat be mindful, so I don't know what I can do. Do you have any ideas?
You can do chanting for it. Chant Namo Tassa Iti Piso Svakato Supatipanno. Do some Buddhist chanting or just play some Buddhist chanting. Find someone, some sutta online and have the cat listen to that. Something. It's not, it's very little, but it's a little something. But again, it's, this is the way of the world. There's a lot of killing and a lot of dying that goes on. It's not really your responsibility to save others or prevent others from, unless there's some, you know, if it was your cat and you're letting other people kill it, then well, maybe there's something there.
Do you have any tips for warming up before meditating? If I tidy up for a few minutes, it seems to help.
Honestly, just to continue on with that, the last question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I've just had some stray thought come in. I'd be more praying for the people who are going to do the killing, or who were encouraging the killing, or were arranging the killing. Your family members, I guess, no, or family members or friends. Because they are, in a sense, your responsibility. It's your responsibility to, yeah, to make it known somehow. Your disagreement, you know, not in a confrontational way, but just to be clear where you stand and to find ways to encourage the people that you care for away from things that are unwholesome. Sorry, someone wants to do stretching before, is it, or breathing before? Or?
No, any tips for warming up before meditating? And they find if they tidy up for a few minutes, it seems to help.
What do you mean by warming up? Are you cold?
I guess for ordering the mind for meditation.
Well, there is something to cleansing the body. It's apparently a thing. Maybe shaving is. Now, there's an idea that that somehow is helpful to clean your room, to tidy things up. Yeah. Sure, but don't make it a trick where you try to find ways to make it easier, you know, because that can be a habit, that can be habit forming, where you're looking for the easy way out, you're looking for things to be easier. We're not really looking for things to be easier, we're looking to be more capable of dealing with things when they're difficult, so wouldn't worry too much about that, warming up.
That is all the questions that we have for now.
Okay.
Did you want me to read the quote, Pante?
No, it's a long one, isn't it?
No. I was thinking it might be good for one of us to read the quote on the days that you talk about the quote, because afterwards, when people watch it afterwards, they wouldn't know which quote we were talking about.
All right, go ahead.
Whoever was greedy and is now free from greed, whoever was hating and is now free from hating, whoever was grudging, hypocritical, spiteful, jealous, mean, untrustworthy, cunning, with evil desires, with wrong views, and is now free from greed, hate, grudge, hypocrisy, spite, jealousy, meanness, untrustworthiness, cunning, evil desires, and wrong views, then he undertakes the practice worthy of monks. In getting rid of these stains, faults, and defects of monks, when he sees himself freed from these things that lead to sorrow, rebirth in a bad place, gladness arises in him. From gladness comes joy. Because of joy, the body is tranquil. With the tranquil body, he is happy, and the mind of one who is happy is concentrated. He abides with a mind filled with love, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, suffusing the first, second, third, and fourth quarters of the world. He abides suffusing the whole world, upwards, downwards, across, everywhere, with a mind filled with love, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, abundant, abounded, without hatred or ill will.
So it's talking about the power of goodness, that there's a sort of a succession here. If you want to be a good person, you have to be happy. If you want to be a happy person, well, you have to be good, in a sense. So, an interesting aspect of this is that it points out the idea of practicing loving kindness and compassion as actually depending on the practice of insight meditation, really. So that there's a precursor to being a loving, kind, compassionate person, and that's being a good person. And being a good person is, well, actually being a happy person first, but being a happy person requires one to be a good person. Being a good person, of course, requires one to be pure and requires wisdom, really, which is the root of all goodness. So there's powerful statements here about happiness as well, happiness coming from goodness, but also about, especially for Buddhists who often get sidetracked by wanting to practice loving kindness and compassion and so on, without having really purified the base, the understanding in the mind. And what happens as a result, it can be quite superficial, where you have love, but underneath there's still ego, there's still attachment, and so it's not deep, you know, there's not a depth to the emotions of love and compassion and so on. Whereas for one who is pure in mind, they do it naturally. They're naturally loving and kind and caring and compassionate. And part of that is because they're happy. I mean, a good point in this is that when one is happy, they just naturally love and care for others. They don't have hatred or ill will. When you're confident, when you have nothing to fear, when you know you're a good person, it makes you tranquil and happy. And people who are not happy, who feel afraid and guilty and so on because of the things that they've done, have a hard time helping others, right? But those who are good people, those who have cultivated goodness, they have the happiness and they have the tranquility, means they have less needs and less desires themselves, so they're able to be a better support for others. If we're all needy, then none of us get anything, right? In a relationship, it's like this. If we say we love each other and that's enough, but well, what do we mean by love? If by love we mean we're attached to each other, being attached to each other means you need other people to make you happy. And if we're both needy and clingy, then any relationship will always fail because neither one gets anything. So, some interesting aspects of the Dhamma here. And then this whole list of all the various defilements is always nice. So now you have a full list, fairly full list, no? Hating, grudging, hypocritical, spiteful, jealous, mean, untrustworthy, cunning, evil desires with wrong views. That's a good list. There's longer lists than that even. But it's a good list of the various things that we're talking about when we regard them as evil. Now, it's a great thing about Buddhism, really. It's not about views. It's not about whether you agree or have to follow certain practices. This is what Buddhism's about. The core value in Buddhism is just goodness. You know, it's about being good, cultivating wholesomeness, cultivating purity, cultivating peace. I don't think there's any other religion that can say that. Maybe Jainism, but they're a little weird.
What do the Buddhists call them? The Jains weird?
Well, they go naked, these guys.
So when it says whoever was greedy and is now free from greed, whoever was hating and is now free from hating, is that implying in the same lifetime as a result of insight gained through meditation, or is this talking about lifetime over lifetime?
No, this is this lifetime. like an arahant is very capable of love and compassion and all these things because they have no need for themselves. Well, we need to maybe get some more people on our hangout, no? We should invite people to come in and chat with us.
We should. Anthony has a question. Maybe he'll come on and ask it.
Right. What we could do, we could post the hangout. We did this before, right? We could post the hangout in the chat. And then if people wanted to join, they could pop in, right?
Yes. Yeah, that was fun. When the abdomen is rising, should I look for gaps in rising? In other words, if the abdomen stopped in the middle of rising, then continued, would I need to note rising twice? How would I know when to do this?
You could, but you don't need to. I mean, this isn't a big deal. The words are not magic, so it's not like you have to find the perfect way. In fact, at that point, you might want to note knowing that you're aware, there's an awareness of the gap. It's never going to be perfect, and that's part of the challenge, is being adaptable, adapting the technique according to the situation. So sure, you can say rising, rising, if it's in stages, or you can just say rising.
So then you wouldn't have to stop and note the space in between.
No, but if you notice it, then it's good. Probably helpful to note knowing. It's not magic though, it's not just about finding the right sequence.
Could mindful prostration be that warming up or preparation before meditation?
Oh yeah, that's a great prep. That's right. There is a warm-up exercise. I was just being kind of cruel actually. It reminded me of this man who said he wanted to stay in shape. Warming up is such a funny phrase. It wasn't your fault. I think I've used it before, saying mindful prostration is a warm-up exercise. I'm just being cruel. Apologies. Okay, that's all then. But yeah, next time, let's put the link into the chat box so people can pop in with their questions. I don't know that it'll help, but we're not getting many questions and there's not that much eagerness to talk to us, so.
Here's another question. Well, you're probably answering all the questions during the individual meditators meetings too.
Some, yeah. Many people have questions. It's funny, you know, sometimes it's very short, sometimes it takes a half an hour.
Mm-hmm. Probably many questions are being asked directly to you, though, I would think.
Yeah.
Lately, knowing has been very helpful. Are there situations in which knowing can become a crutch?
Knowing, you mean noting knowing is what you're saying, I guess.
Yes, lately noting knowing has been very helpful.
Well, you should note that as well. knowing that it's been very helpful, because you don't want to get attached to that. Yeah, you can get attached to it. You have to say knowing that you're attached. Liking, you'd have to know it. There was one nun in Jomtong. I was listening to them. There was this monk, one of the big monks in Jomtong, became a meditation teacher, but he was only doing it, I think, as a feather in his cap to become some high-ranking monk, because it looks really good on a resume. Yes, they have resumes. And I was listening because they were doing it right outside my kuti. He was doing his reporting, and he was doing it with this nun who was a well-experienced meditation teacher. I think she still is. She has her own center now. But she's kind of funny. So she, whenever anyone had anything, she would say, "Well, just say knowing, knowing." And then the next one came, it was knowing, knowing, just say knowing, knowing. And for almost everything, it was knowing, knowing. And eventually this monk says, "Oh yeah, she really likes that knowing thing." Like, sort of a backhanded way of saying, what the heck, you know?
One size fits all.
Yeah, I mean, that's where it gets a little too much. Like, I don't know. I don't remember, but it seemed a little bit over the top. Everything was knowing, knowing. If it is knowing, then it's knowing, but it's not a catch-all. There's many things that aren't knowing. They are different kinds of experience.
Since there's no kind of central hierarchy in Buddhism, how does one become a high-ranking monk?
Oh, there's a big hierarchy. Thailand is the biggest, probably.
Oh, okay, so it's divided by country?
Yeah. Yep, they have what they call Thai Buddhism, which is kind of silly. And then there's Sri Lankan Buddhism and Burmese Buddhism.
And
Ridiculous.
every country has some sort of a structure.
Yeah, I mean, the actual Buddhism has nothing to do with the country, so to say Thai Buddhism is really ridiculous. They're not talking about Buddhism. They're talking about Thai Buddhists, Thai Buddhist organization, or a means of organizing Buddhists, which could be useful, but is usually not. Usually not all that useful. In most cases, just about bribery and not nepotism, but cronyism, I guess. So you use money and you use power to rise up in the ranks and fawning over the head monks in order to get ranks and that kind of thing, you know. Lots of invitations and making other, you make the big monks look good by inviting them and by promoting them, and then they in turn turn around and promote you. I mean, that's mostly what it's about. I was told you want to become a big monk, you just have to go in. Well, it wasn't me, but this other monk wasn't getting promoted, and I said, "Why aren't you getting promoted?" He said, "Because I don't ever go to see the high monks."
He wasn't playing the game.
Wasn't playing the game. The other monks were rising very quickly, and he said, "It's because they go and see the head monk every so often, and fawn all over him and that kind of thing." It's kind of ridiculous. It's nothing. It's the antithetical to Buddhism. So much ego and attachment and greed. It's really, really strong greed. For what? For a rank? For a fan? You get a special fan thing. Yeah. Ajahn Tong is way up there in the ranks. But he's never. In a way, what he does kind of looks like fawning, but he's just so respectful and kind conscientious to keep the Sangha alive and to support the monastic organization. That everyone loves him, but he's so genuine about it. I mean, he's one of these people who you just know is doing it because they believe it. That's the difference.
When you talk about like Thai Buddhism, is there any kind of a sense of trying to send monks to other countries to spread Buddhism, or do they really kind of keep it in the country?
Thailand has never been interested. So, well, there's some talk about it, you know. Dhammakaya has done huge things. They've spread their religion to the world, but I don't know if that's even really entirely Buddhist. But there's some talk, and they do have temples all over the world, but they're usually for Thai people, right? There's never been much interest in spreading it to non-Thais. I guess they have this kind of sense that people like me will come to Thailand, pick up Thai Buddhism, and bring it back. But I think they're mostly content with this, with the Ajahn Chah group as being their voice. It's sort of the We know what they know that they have that group of foreign monks at Wat Pananachat, and they're doing their thing around the world. So that's enough, because that's very Thai. I would say Wat Pananachat has kept very much more to Thai Buddhism than I have, certainly. I've never been into Thai Buddhism, and I haven't stuck with it. We do chanting here every night. It's more Sri Lankan than it is Thai. There's a few Thai things that I incorporate, but only the things that I think, hey, that's nice. I just keep them because I think they're nice, that's all. Not because they're Thai. I've given up all the Thai chants because I think they're awful. I mean, they're so inferior to the old, old chants. It's just nothing. No comparison.
So the chants aren't in Pali?
Yeah. Yeah, but they're new. This prince made them up, I think.
Oh, he made up Pali chants?
Yeah. No, he was very, very clever, very smart. He was actually,
wow,
I think, a good guy, but probably a little bit over the top about his own importance. Actually, no, apparently he wasn't a very nice guy. He was very mean to Sri Lankan monks who came to visit and that kind of thing. Well, there was a Western monk who came to visit, and boy, he was treated really poorly. The first Western monk, Jnana Tiloka, has a very bad things to say about this monk, only because this monk treated him awfully, apparently. It was many years ago. But, yeah. Anyway, it's not neither here nor there. Maybe he was a good guy, but his chants are not. Yeah, they're not. They don't feel the same. Maybe I was a monk in a past life and I was in Sri Lanka, or I remember the old chants, because they're night and day. You know, the old chants feel good. They feel right.
So the Sri Lankan chants are more in the original format, or?
They're older. I mean, Cambodian chanting is very much like Sri Lankan chanting. Lao, to some extent, still keeps the old ones. At Doi Suthep in Chiang Mai, every holy day we'd revert back to the old chantings, which was a sign. As I understand, in Chiang Mai they used to do the old style, but then this king guy or prince guy in Bangkok came up with all this new chanting so that they could have Thai Buddhism. It's kind of ridiculous, you see. You know, when we should be really uniting with all the other Buddhist, Theravada Buddhist countries, they do something explicitly or things explicitly to make themselves different and distinct. That's absurd. And it went on to the point where this Papimondham, this monk who was just awesome and really instrumental in bringing Vipassana from Burma to Thailand, bringing Abhidhamma studies to Thailand, starting Buddhist universities in Thailand. He was really instrumental in all this. Level 9 Pali, so he was a huge scholar, also a meditator, also a monk who believed in Dutanga, so he would go and live under an umbrella and that kind of thing. Just a really neat monk. But he was sending monks to foreign countries to learn Buddhism, sent them to India. He started this thing of sending Thai monks to India to get a degree in Buddhist studies before they had a Buddhist university. Sending monks to other countries like Burma. He sent monks to Burma to learn Abhidhamma and to learn Buddhism and to learn meditation from the Burmese, because when he went, he saw that the Burmese were really learning the Tipitaka, and in Thailand they didn't do that. In Thailand, since this other monk, this prince monk, he wrote these textbooks on Dhamma and on Pali, and so they've got these 9 levels of Pali, and in 9 levels of Pali, you only learn the very basics of Pali grammar, like what I taught you guys. That's about all you learn. Well, there's a bit more. But there's so much more in depth for the Pali and for the Dhamma. So the Dhamma studies are just basic. Like I remember I was telling you about the two of this, 3 of that, and so on. It's just very basic stuff. And there's 3 levels of it. But if you get to the 3 levels in Thailand, you're considered to be a Dhamma master, which is ridiculous because you haven't even opened the Tipitaka yet. So many of my students in the West who read the whole Tipitaka, read the Digha Nikaya, the Majjhima Nikaya, they're far more learned about Buddhism than most monks who are supposed to be masters. So he was railing against this. This isn't just me. This was a high-ranking Thai monk. He was one of the top. He almost became the son, the king of the supreme patriarch. He was at the level. He was next in line or something, or he was one of the ones who would be a candidate. And then they just destroyed him, ruined his reputation, put him in jail eventually. It's an incredible story. And all
Wow.
the people who conspired against him ended up having horrible things happen to them, just naturally freak of nature things happening to them. Anyone who accused him, they all had horrible things happen to them. And finally he was put in jail. He was forced to wear white robes. And stripped of all his ranks, stripped of everything, he was pushed to disrobe, and he wouldn't disrobe. And it all, if you read this story, I read this, my Thai wasn't very good, but I was reading this Thai, and just the feeling that goes through you of awe and reverence for this guy who went through so much and was in jail for 3 years. And when he was in jail, people asked him later, "Well, how was it being in jail?" He said, "It was great. I had no responsibilities. I had a guard 24 hours a day. People brought food to my room. I was totally undisturbed." And he wrote a translation to the Visuddhimagga in Thai, which they still distribute as the translation of the Visuddhimagga, the book that we study. He did the Thai translation while he was in jail, and when he got out of jail, this huge movement started and ended with him being reinstated and being made the, I think, almost the supreme patriarch. He was like the person on behalf, or the person acting as, I don't know exactly how it works, I don't remember the final outcome, but he was complete. They couldn't reinstate him because the supreme patriarch, the ex-supreme patriarch, was the one who had demoted him. So they said they couldn't do that. And all these supporters that came up with these arguments as to why it could be done and how they weren't gonna. And there was something about monks even starving themselves, refusing to eat if they didn't. It was just such an injustice that there was such a movement, and a really neat thing to watch, to read about. I mean,
That's
maybe a little bit overpassionate, but throughout it all, he was not pushing for anything. He was totally fine with whatever happened, and just really a good story. I mean, he was originally accused. They got this woman to go to the police and accused him of raping her. And she wrote a letter saying that he had, or she confessed, or she not confessed, she accused him of this to the police. And it was just a ridiculous situation, and people, went to her and pushed her to come forward with the truth, and eventually she wrote a letter, and the letter was just incredible. It made the hair stand up on my arms, because she said I have to confess because I can't sleep at night. She said, "I just want to be able to sleep at night. I don't want to go to hell." Could you imagine just the horror of having done such a horrible, awful thing as collude with such evil? It's just, to read this book, I've still got it, I think, here in Thai. It's called Bachuan Man, which means meeting Mara in combat, I think, or else it means, I think that's what it means. It means meeting Mara on the battlefield, sort of.
During what period of time did this take place, Bhante?
55 years ago, somewhere around that, somewhere around the 2500 anniversary, something, somewhere just after that time, I think. So Ajahn Tong was a student, or he was one of the people that Prapimon Tham sent to Burma to learn meditation also, but also the Abhidhamma. So they were learning meditation in Thailand. He was sent to see how they did it in Burma, but also to learn Abhidhamma, and he spent a year there, I think, or he spent some time there.
And that's where Ajahn Tong learned the Mahasi Sayadaw.
No, he learned it in either Chiang Mai or Bangkok, as I understand. He was already practicing it in Thailand. But because he was selected, Probably also because he was from Chiang Mai, he was the representative from the north. But I think all, you know, he was just someone who they thought was proficient. I mean, you think he's always been exceptional. He's one of these people who was born a good person, you know, something like that. I mean, the stories they tell him, just one of those special people. I mean, I sound like a fanboy, right? But I think it's objective to say. I think anyone who meets him has to admit, has to accept he's this is not an ordinary person.
Here's a question. I try to formally meditate several times a day, which helps a lot, but it is hard to be mindful throughout the day. How can I continue that same feeling all day?
Sorry, it's hard to be mindful all day.
Well, he meditates formally several times a day, but it's hard to be mindful throughout the day. How can he continue the same feeling all day?
Yeah, well, become an arahant, no? It's a habit. You have to build it. There's no. If you could do that, you would have succeeded. It would no longer be practice, it would be perfect. That's why we don't call it perfect, we call it practice. Practice makes perfect. You wouldn't call it practice if you could, if it were perfect.
And another question, why do monks chant? Tradition, or does it serve a purpose?
It serves purposes, you know, it's a communal thing. It's about remembering the Dhamma, it's about paying respect to the Buddha. It's a meditation, a means of calming the mind, reaffirming your commitments, reaffirming your dedication. It's about asking forgiveness and that kind of thing. There's quite a bit that we do in the chanting. There's lots of different things you can chant. And the people downstairs are watching, are listening or watching, I think. They're supposed to be meditating. No, it's good. It's good because then I don't have to give them a Dhamma talk. They can listen in on this one.
You should be up there with you.
Yeah, they could. You could see them all. Could meet them all.
Yeah, that would be nice.
We should get them up here to introduce themselves.
Yes.
I mean, it's just, it's Rushanti and Shehan, they're a couple.
Yeah.
I'll introduce you to Vanessa when she comes. Vanessa's an old-time meditator. She came to meditate with me in Sri Lanka. I guess that was it. She was going to come another time when I was in Thailand, maybe. I don't think she ever made it. She went somewhere else. I think she went to Jomtong to practice.
Why do some Buddhists pray?
I don't know. Prayer can be useful, you know, it's good for devoting your mind to something. I think if you pray for world peace, may there be peace on earth, then you're likely to devote your attention to the attainment of world peace. So that's a good prayer. But if you're praying to God, that's not really a Buddhist thing. Or praying to Buddha, or praying to angels. Yeah, I mean, whatever. To each their own. It's not really Buddhist, though. First draft of my essay today. Tomorrow I have to go over it and submit it. Oh, this was right. Today someone asked me to write an article on mindfulness for a academic journal.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, well, that made me think I'm not really an academic, and this is the sort of reason why I'm trying to get a bachelor degree. So I can at least say that, and not just say, but so that I can have the sort of the ability to write papers, because I am learning that, and I knew that I would be getting back in shape. I was never very good at writing a cogent paper, because it's a skill. You have to really read the articles, and you have to process them, and you have to put together an argument, you know, and that is a skill. I don't think I've ever been very good at it. I can write really well, actually, because I've read since I was very young. So my writing skills, my grammar and everything is often over the top because I'm, you know, very picky about grammar. Of course, I have my own grammar with the semicolons, but yeah, putting together arguments, you know, maybe there's something to going to school. It's funny being at school with all these kids. I mean, they're nice, and it's actually nice being there because I can be supportive. I was thinking we should have some kind of once a week where we feed them or something, because I think some of them are not eating well because they don't have a lot of money. You know, it's really a money issue. You know, this whole idea of starving students,
yeah.
Isn't that horrible?
Well, that was my senior year.
Really?
I could barely afford groceries. I was so hungry all the time.
Wow.
It was tough. Very tough.
And then your grades suffer as a result. See, they won't
yeah.
say, but I'm assuming some of the kids that I talk to are in that boat. Some of them, of course, are
yeah.
well off, but man, I'm sitting this girl who I sit with in my class and her friend as well. They both work. She has two jobs. I think her friend Sarah, the other woman who I taught meditation, I don't know, she has at least one job. But it's, you know, really to have to work while you're going to school is ridiculous, I think. You know, I mean, university student by day, scooping ice cream by night, that kind of thing, you know.
Well, we have the work-study programs. It's part of your actual student aid package.
You have to work.
Yes, so they're going to give you X amount of money, but you do have to work for it. And the job that I had was actually in the student aid office, which
uh-huh.
led to my first job after university. Mm-hmm. So it actually worked out well for me. I kind of liked it, but I did have to work. It was 25, 30 hours a week, and then I had a second job on top of that at the mall. So.
And then you think, you know, because no one reads the philosophy course we're doing, no one's read the book. No one's read the three books. You know, very few people. He said, my TA said, I would be very surprised if there's more than a handful of people who have done half the reading for the class. And then, so I was saying, you know, then it's a failure. The class is a failure. It didn't do what it was supposed to do. People didn't read. People didn't learn. It's something, there's a huge design flaw.
Do you think there was too much reading or
no,
just not interesting enough?
No, everyone
material?
Was... knew that they didn't have to and was so busy with other things, either courses that mattered to make them money, you know, because philosophy is an elective, or because they were working, you know, because they have 30, you know, working 30 hours a week, and then you're supposed to read about free will and the nature of consciousness, the nature of reality. Can't do it. Anyway, I thought I'd mention that there is maybe a reason to be at university to get a degree. You have a bachelor, right, Robin?
I do. It's in marketing. How embarrassing is
Oh.
that?
Well, it's
Would you?
good for us. You can be our market. That's why you're such a good marketer for us.
I was 18 when I picked out my major. You don't know
Oh.
anything when you're 18. I was looking through the brochure and thought, wow, marketing, that sounds like fun. And I found out that that means a lot of time sales and going around and selling pharmaceuticals and things like that. And I really wasn't into that, so I never actually worked in the field, but the interest is there, because I think that, promotion, when you are promoting a good thing, it's useful to let people know about a good thing. And so those skills, I do think they can be wholesome. It's not always about making money. Sometimes it's just about promoting something that's useful and helpful to people.
Awesome. Indeed, can be good. Buddha was a promoter of good things.
Yes. And who was the Asoka? He was the real promoter too, wasn't he?
He
Asoka.
put ads up all over the country. Could you imagine if Ahsoka had the internet? He wouldn't have had to put up all those stone tablets. He would have tweeted it. I think the stone tablets, there's a charm to them that's lost in tweets, no?
Oh
You
yeah,
can't
they
compare a tweet and a stone tablet, a stone pillar.
nobody's changing a stone tablet. That's not on Google Drive or Google Docs. There's no editing.
Of course, you can't retweet a stone tablet, a stone pillar. That's the problem. It can't go viral.
No, I guess not.
Mean, there is something to this, but it's very quick moving, quick to expand, quick to broadcast. It's also quick to disappear. That's a danger. Anyway. Okay, I'm gonna go. That's enough for me. No more questions?
No more questions.
All right, good night. See you all tomorrow. We have Isudimanga, we have meetings, and we'll have a broadcast tomorrow night.
Thank you, Bante.
Thank you for tuning in. Thanks, Robin, for taking part.
Good night.
Good night.